Gwen Hoy grew up on a hog farm in Topeka. Her parents still own that farm, but now she runs a place of her own. She runs a ranch out in the heart of the Flint Hills. It's tough work, but there's a lot Gwen loves about it.
Being around the animals, nature, working with your family, just working together on something that you love and value.
But cows really don't care that you're starting a family and have a new baby. They demand to be fed no matter what's going on in your life. So Gwen, as a new mother, did all of her work toting an infant daughter.
I carried her in a baby Bjorn for about a year while we rode pastures. My mom made sunbonnets for her, and I had her in little bib overalls.
As Gwen's daughter got older, the two kept working side by side, but with the daughter now riding her own pony. She did her fair share of the work, stopping every now and then to play in the creek. And as she got older, the neighbors started asking questions.
A lot of people are surprised that we don't have another child, like a son, who will inherit and run the ranch. So maybe that is one of the biggest misconceptions, that women can't run a ranch.
Misconception indeed. In fact, the New York Times recently declared that women are reclaiming the American West by running their own ranches in higher numbers than ever. And this is at the same time as men increasingly are stepping away from that kind of work. I'm Gina Kaufman, and since we're in the part of the country that the New York Times probably considers the West, we want to scratch beneath the surface of that headline about women and ranching on KCUR's Central Standard. My first guest is Jacqueline Smith. She runs Central Grazing Company near Lawrence, where she grazes flocks of grass-fed lamb, and full disclosure, she also happens to be my friend. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Gina. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Do you relate to this story we just heard from Gwen Hoy in the Flint Hills?
Yeah, absolutely, especially the part about towing your children into the field to work. I mean, I've got two boys. They're ages 6 and 3 now, and both of them have journeyed with me in backpacks, strapped to our side-by-side to go take care of the sheep, and absolutely.
What is it like to raise children that way?
It is sometimes very frustrating, and sometimes it's mostly very rewarding because, you know, being able to, like, take your children with you and experience just day-to-day life and not have, like, these segments of, like, schedules of you have to be here and you have to be doing this thing, but just kind of having the freedom to kind of explore the world. And when we go out to the farm, there are definitely boundaries that my children live by as far as, like, where they can go and what they can do on the farm, but they have pretty much a lot of freedom, so they can explore tools and build things and be creative and play and find bugs. And so it's a really kind of a cool experience to watch them see the world from that very micro perspective.
Yeah, so many people talk about, like, the work-life balance, and your work and life are the same thing.
It's the same, right? There's no separation between it.
Tell the story of how you got into this line of work, because you did not grow up doing that. Am I right?
No, I mean, farming was the furthest thing from me, even though, you know, we're from the Midwest. I was born in Missouri and have experienced farming just around me all my life. My family were not farmers. We didn't come from farming. And in fact, looking back through our generations of our family lineage, there's no farmers. We're all merchants or in construction. And so when I came to my parents at a very young age of, like, I mean, I was, you know, 19, 20, and said, hey, look, I'm going to be a sheep farmer. It was like the kind of a crazy idea, and one that they probably didn't think I was going to hold on to. And, you know, 20 years later, here we still are raising sheep.
So you got into it for your own reasons. What were those when you were a 19, 20-year-old woman?
Well, when I was younger and going to college, I graduated UMKC actually with a fine arts degree. And no one ever encouraged me or told me that farming could actually be a career, especially for someone who doesn't have an agricultural background and for being a woman. Just wasn't a career choice that anyone kind of pinpointed. But I kind of credit my grandparents, who are, especially my grandmother, who was really much into growing and living with her plants that she grew. She had a really beautiful green thumb, and I really admired that. And so as I was growing up, I learned to love to grow things. And in my perspective, it was a vegetable farmer. I thought I was going to be a vegetable farmer.
And that, from a gender standpoint, I think that that's what people, for whatever reason, picture.
Yeah.
A woman who is a farmer is out in the fields growing vegetables or something.
Yeah, I think it's a much easier connection for people to make, especially when the farmer, the woman, doesn't have a connection to agriculture. It's a bigger leap to go into ranching, for sure. But I was
Animal husbandry.
Or animal husbandry, or dealing with any of that stuff. And, you know, I didn't know prior to starting my farming career, I didn't know the difference between a sheep and a goat. Like, that's how far removed I was from agriculture in itself. And so it was a huge learning curve that I had to go through. But I was really prone to like how the animals were raised and wanted to make sure that I was part of the solution, not part of the problem. So I decided to give ranching a go.
So in that article in the Times, they profiled a fourth generation owner and operator of a ranch out in Washington who also trains women in animal husbandry. And she talks about hating the sort of like country pop image of the cowgirl to the point that she refers to her own ranch as a rhinestone-free zone. Yeah. Do you relate to that?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's really farming is dirty, hard work. And there's like really not a lot of room for fashion or like shiny things like rhinestones. It's really hard. I mean, when women are out there working, we're trucking, especially right now, we're working in mud up to our ankles and dealing with the whole cycle of life and death. And there's beautiful times to it. And it's also not so beautiful parts of farming as well, especially when you're dealing with agriculture from a ranching perspective.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? What are some of the challenges and some of the, I mean, not gender-specific challenges, just challenges that ranchers face and hard truths and dirty things. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, it goes back to that. The thing that we always hear is that weather and working with nature is very difficult. And so we're really dependent on what's happening in the environment. And we're really dependent on how the climate is performing. If it's a drought year like we just had throughout the summer, then we don't have enough feed to feed our livestock through the winter with hay because there was just not hay available. Now, most of the farmers who are ranchers are calving or they're having lambs, and we're dealing with this really incredibly abnormally cold February, where most of us schedule lambing in February or calving in February because you kind of have a hit and miss there. But for the most part, you got some nice weather in February, and it's not the way it is now. So the challenges are kind of going with those punches, like planning for it. And I just had a conversation with a farmer the other day, and I think this is very true. It's kind of funny on some level, but he said, you know, farmers are always planning for the next year because the year that's happening right now is never the year that they had hoped for the previous year. So they're always looking in the future to try to figure out how they can make this year better. And when you're working with nature, it just, nothing can be planned really.
And so, but what you're planning has to do with animals and life cycles and feeding and not rhinestones.
Not rhinestones. No, we're looking at, I mean, from a more technical farming perspective, we're looking at the entire ecosystem of our farm. You know, we're looking at how the microbes are performing with the grasses and how are the ecosystems from the prairie mice to like the winged prey, how they all work together to make a healthier ecosystem on the farm. So it's definitely a much bigger picture that we're working on than just rhinestones.
Are there things that you specifically, as someone who didn't grow up in this kind of agricultural world, as someone who wasn't sort of like raised to take over a family farm, are there things that have been hard for you to learn or get used to?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge for me personally is the fact that I don't know equipment or machinery. And I wasn't, when I have an issue with a piece of equipment, that I really do have to rely on my neighbors to kind of help guide me. And most of them are men out there where we are. Well, all of them, really. And so I definitely have to rely on their expertise, because a lot of those farmers that are around us have multi-generational experience, and they were growing up working on tractors with their dads. And so that's probably the biggest challenge that I have. But thankfully, there are lots of my colleagues out there that are willing to help and step in when I need a little to answer some questions or to help me work on troubleshooting what's happening with a piece of equipment.
Do you think that gender does have something to do with like that gap in knowledge? And I mean, I'm just curious whether there's a movement actually like for a next generation to be learning things like how to fix a tractor.
I don't really know how to answer that question, because I'm not sure. Our situation is so unique because we're not multi-generational farmers. You know, we're just the first generation. I definitely allow my kids to like play around with equipment and to experience that and be around when we're doing the simple maintenance of vehicles. And I hope that they learn those techniques. But as far as like really teaching them, I don't have that skill set to teach them.
Yeah. Do you network with other women who are doing this, who are in ranching?
I have a broad network, but they're not localized. I mean, I have some good colleagues who are women that are really small around my area, and I know who they are and reach out. And it definitely is a kind of a tight knit of women ranchers. But nationally, I think most of my experience are women farmers tend to be more populated in, you know, Washington and California and Oregon, and where all the places that, you know, the New York Times hit instead of the Midwest as like a agricultural region, they picked that area to write about, which was interesting to me. I'm not sure why that is. It might be that, you know, we have just a strong culture of this one type of farming, which is really kind of like a cow-calf operation where ranchers raise their cows and sell their calves as they get to a certain size, mostly to feedlots to be fattened and sold to the industry. And women are kind of spearheading and leading this new niche agricultural movement with regenerative farming, when they're really paying close attention to how to restore and conserve the soil and build microbes and have a broader relationship between balancing our carbon cycle, which is really a nurturing perspective on farming. And women tend to be like leading that niche market.
Let's bring Barb Downey in on this. She's the president of the Kansas Livestock Association. Hi, Barb.
Good morning.
What are your thoughts and observations on this, just this larger demographic shift in ranching and whether we're seeing it in Kansas?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a demographic shift or is something that is just being recognized now. Jacqueline was talking about her experiences, and I wish you could see me. I was just sitting here nodding my head to everything that she said. Our experiences are very much similar in that regards, but I am a cow-calf operator here in the Flint Hills, and the differences I do see is two of my best friends, or they are my best friends, are both women ranchers. One is the primary lead at her ranch. Her husband is a banker in town. The other one is a full partner with her husband, and she probably makes more of the management decisions. And he's much like my husband in my situation. I'm doing a lot of the financial and planning work, also working outside, but my husband would be in a corporate structure, the COO, and I am the CEO.
And that matters to you, it sounds like, identity-wise.
Identity-wise, no, it doesn't really. I guess the point I'm trying to make is these are partnerships on the ranch that recognize each individual's strengths, and we kind of, you know, like any good management situation, you let the person do what they're good at, and then find complementary skills to balance your team. And historically, I think that is what, especially ranching, has always played to, men and women working together more as equals than was historically true in a lot of other industries.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to talk more about this supposed trend of women becoming ranchers in higher numbers coming up on KCUR Central Standard. We'll hear how it plays out locally. And if you have a story to share or a question to ask, call in. We're 816-235-2888. Whether you grew up on a ranch and saw the women who were always working there, or maybe you've considered this line of work for yourself. 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about women in ranching. We're hearing stories and getting the big picture here in our area after a New York Times article proclaimed that women are reclaiming ranching in the American West. Jacqueline Smith of Central Grazing Company, hello again.
Hi.
And Barb Downey of the Kansas Livestock Association, hello to you too.
Good morning.
Okay, so one thing, I mean, we haven't addressed like whether there are numbers telling us what's going on with women in ranching in the Midwest. And we did some research behind the scenes trying to track down those numbers, and it seems like the information we have is really anecdotal at this point.
Yeah, I think that's very true. If I look just at Central Grazing Company's network of producer partners that we work with, so we raise our own sheep for our company, Central Grazing Company, but we also aggregate other lambs who fit our specs in Missouri, Kansas, and Iowa. And we, at this point, have about 20 farmers. And of those 20 farmers, two of them are women as the lead in their ranch. They all definitely have women partners, but the ones who make the decision and do the business there are two of those that are women.
What do you read into that personally?
Well, I think I actually think that's a good sign, honestly. The New York Times quoted something like 14% change or shift in the gender of the role of the farmer in the article. And, we're kind of at that mark. I mean, I think that that's a positive plus, that women are feeling empowered enough to actually go out there and be the business leaders that agricultural ranchers need to be.
Barb, what is your sense of why we don't have numbers on this?
I can't answer that. I think the USDA probably does. They have some programs to help both young farmers and ranchers develop, and I believe they have some minority ones, which they would consider women in agriculture minority. So I think they probably have better numbers on it. But I think just looking at the history of agriculture, it's all, in my experience, has always been teamwork and not, whether the lead was male or female hasn't been something that we've historically focused on.
So shifting to ranching specifically and like the image of who does that, I mean, the cowboy is this totally iconic American character. There's the whole mythology around this cowboy figure who's this tough, rugged loner out on the prairie and specifically a cowboy. So I'm curious whether that's something that you identify with in some ways or if you consider that kind of a stereotype that's harmful to ranchers or potential ranchers who don't fit the bill. Barb, I'll start with you.
I don't think it's harmful. I think that's pretty true, except for the gender specificity. But, I'm sitting here this morning. I've got a little bit of afterbirth on my jeans as I'm sitting here at my desk. Been out since, first thing this morning. We're currently calving on the ranch. It is hard work, just like Jacqueline said. It's dirty work. It's long, long hours a day. So I think that icon is accurate, except that it can be male or female, and is.
Except, are you also alone, even with someone you love?
oftentimes, it's divide and conquer. I'm more of a team worker. I love to work together, but there's plenty of times that you're just by yourself. My husband may be going through one particular group of cows and bringing their exposing their daily grazing to them. I may be out doing something else entirely. If we're putting up grazing paddocks, maybe we're working together. There is a lot of alone time.
Jacqueline, tell me about how you relate to this cowboy image.
I have a slightly different perspective on that. And I think it's because I didn't come from an agricultural background. And for me, that image of that cowboy was really a huge mountain to climb over for me because I didn't identify that a woman could be a rancher. Like, I didn't know that that was a possibility for me as a young woman, as a career choice, that this is something I could go into. So I really had to shift that image in my head. And like, what does it mean to be someone who works the fields, who is connected to the soil, connected to how the ecosystem work, and find that connection between that rugged image and the hard work and being the feminine person, the nurture, caring for that ecosystem. And to me now, that image is totally shifted. And so now the image to me looks like a more feminine role.
Can you describe the image that you have of yourself out there doing that work? I mean, I've seen the images on your website, and I think that they speak volumes to that. But I'd be curious to hear you describe in your own words how you see that person.
Yeah, I think it really shifted to me when I became a mother, honestly, because then I actually had the words or the feeling to connect that image. Like you mentioned before, that our life is very much the same. It doesn't change. Our life and our career is what it is. That is also working with our children too. And when I became a mother, I was able to kind of tap into that nurturing feeling and apply that to my farm. So I was able to kind of make that connection from a more feminine approach.
When we hear the description that our other guest has, you know, afterbirth on our genes, yeah. And, you know, like, and you're talking about like out there fixing equipment.
Yeah.
You see that through a specifically feminine lens, all of that stuff?
Yeah, I do. I'm really connected to it. You start looking at farming as an ecosystem. How do these things, these components work holistically to manage your life, essentially? And farming fits really nicely into that kind of schedule, if you want to call that, but the holistic life cycle where everything about you is part of this land that you are working, your family, the animals on your land, your friends, everything works together in harmony in a holistic way. And I think women kind of already have intuitive ability to look at their lives holistically because we manage many different things on a day-to-day level. Most women still take care, are the lead in child care in their homes, and most women still work. So having to balance that, women tend to take that holistic approach more in their lives, I think. I know that's a stereotype. But
it's so interesting to me that we have, you know, one example of someone who sees like the historic image as accurate minus the gender specificity, and that we have one guest who sees ranching as a specifically feminine image that she relates to. Do you see that there is this kind of like range of interpretations, Jacqueline, out there in your network?
I wonder if that has to do on some level with the fact that, as I said before, like I didn't have a background in agriculture. So I had to define it for what it looked like to me. And that coming over that challenge of it being this male-dominated industry and still working my way through that as a woman to this day, I have to re-identify with it a lot. But I think it also might have to do with the fact that, like our other guest was talking about, that it is a partnership between mostly, if it is a male and female partnership, that they're working really closely to connection as a team. And so those roles of who does what might be a little bit more blurred, and that image might be a little bit more blurry. But when you have a true female role without a male counterpart on there, then that image might shift a little bit too.
Barb, jump in here.
Yeah, again, I wish you guys could see me just nodding along. Jacqueline described her life as an ecosystem, and that was something that I had never really put together. You know, we too look at our ranch very holistically as an ecosystem and really work hard to recognize the importance of every piece and its functions. Some we know, some we don't know. So we make sure, you know, that we're looking at everything holistically and have it in place. And Jacqueline, you're dead on right that our lives are very much that way too. And I was sitting there as you were talking about not growing up in agriculture, and I did grow up in agriculture, but I was sitting there thinking about my interactions with my dad, who was very much had no preconceived notions about what boys and girls could do. I have two brothers, one sister. I was the only one interested in agriculture. So he focused on that interest. Here's the kid who's interested. And then there was never, man, I just never felt anything from my dad or any of the folks that I was around that I was somehow different because I was female. So I, you know, now with a little bit broader perspective on that, I really recognize and appreciate, you know, what my dad did for me in helping me to develop.
Barb, was there a point when you sort of like encountered a wider world than just your sort of family and immediate family friends and neighbors, I guess, that did you start encountering people who treated the fact that you were a woman in ranching differently?
Maybe it's just blind ignorance, but you know, I can honestly say I have never picked up on that. Maybe I have subconsciously, and then I don't end up doing business with those folks for one reason or another. But I've always felt that agriculture was more open to recognizing the strengths of an individual and utilizing those to their best ability. You know, when you're out there and there's a job that needs to be done and you've got someone capable, the last thing you're looking at is their gender. You're just looking at, there's that capable person, let's let them run.
Jacqueline, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it might be a slightly different perspective because she has definitely a male counterpart that she works very closely with, and they definitely have a strength where one person can take the role where their strengths are more present. I don't have that counterpart in our farming operation. So when I am out trying to do business with people or I'm trying to buy whatever it is, there's a lot of times when I get a question of, you know, well, where's your husband? Or, you know, I've had to tell multiple people that I've done business with not to call me sweetheart or honey or babe. And that's just kind of par for the course when you're working in a kind of a male-dominated industry without having that counterpart where I can defer to when situations get rough. But I absolutely agree that when I'm confronted with those challenges, I tend not to do business with those kinds of people.
So, Barb, I understand that there was an organization in Montana that was sort of like vocally opposed to women running ranches and that you issued a response to that organization. Can you talk to me about that?
Oh, it's been many, many years ago. It wasn't an organization. It was an article about a family ranching operation in Montana. And one of the men involved in the operation said something about they almost hate to see girl children born because they know that means that there will be son-in-laws and then the leadership gets fractured and all of that. And that, man, that hit me wrong. I fired off a very terse letter to the editor, which they did print, suggesting that, you know, well, I was pretty coarse in my response, I guess. Not coarse enough that it didn't get published, but I was very direct and left no doubt that their views were very much antiquated. I think Kansas actually is maybe a little microcosm that's a little bit better. I have heard more than one story about some of the more traditional Western ranching lands, places like Montana, that are a little more sexist, I guess. I would, at the risk of painting with a broad brush, Texas, I think, is somewhat the same way. Kansas, you know, maybe we're a special place, or maybe I just go along not recognizing something that is there, but I genuinely don't think it's here in my relationships in Kansas. You know, I end up doing a lot of the business for our ranch, and I think I have a strong personality too, and I just go forward. You know, like I haven't ever been asked, what does your husband think? Maybe I've just not run into it, but I have experienced it secondhand in other states.
Barb, for you, I mean, when you were laying out your argument for why that kind of thinking expressed by the rancher in Montana, when you were laying out your argument for why that was antiquated, can you explain a little bit of it? Not that we need you to defend it, but just I'm curious how you explained what was wrong with that.
Well, I just think it's short-sighted. I'd go back to, again, you know, Jacqueline and I, you know, both bring different things to the table as individuals and as ranchers. It is just short-sighted to not recognize what someone brings to the table and use it to better your operation. And that's what I always like to point out. To those folks that, you know, maybe don't think women have some place in ranching, man, you're missing a lot of strengths that that person brings to the table. If you've not grown up in agriculture, you are not constrained by what your parents did and didn't do, how things have always been on this ranch. Jacqueline brings wide open eyes to agriculture. She sees things that someone growing up in agriculture doesn't see. To not recognize those strengths and Jacqueline's particular gifts is hamstringing your own, you know, your own business. Whether or not, now I'm talking about that daughter of a ranching family in Montana, to not recognize strengths is short-sighted.
Barb, talk to me about the future of ranching, how it's changing more broadly, and what gender either does or doesn't have to do with it.
Again, when Jacqueline talked about systems management, she is just dead on for the way that we're approaching our ranching operations and for a way, the way that I see a lot of successful ranching operations approaching. It's a very much a system. We need to, as ranchers, as land managers, as cow managers, need to recognize the importance of each piece of the system, pay attention to it, make sure it's healthy, make sure we're supporting that system. And I think that's the way we set ourselves up for success going down the road.
Jacqueline, what would be your advice to a woman who thinks she wants to do this for a living?
Go for it. That's my advice. It's a lot of hard work. It takes a really, there's a, if you don't have the agricultural background, there's a steep learning curve.
Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, you just like anything that you're learning, I had to learn how to become a farmer just doing it, just jumping in. There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of tears involved in that. And it was really difficult because a farmer wears many, many different types of hats. I mean, we're fundamentally looking a perspective of like the soil from a scientific perspective and understanding that ecosystem connection. Then we have to be mechanics and engineers and electricians and business people and marketers and all of that gamut. We have to hold those skill sets
and weather forecasters
pretty much. And like how to take it with the, you know, take the punches that come with you. And so it's a lot of hard work, but there are really great people out there, and farmers, I truly believe this, for the most part, are really good collaborators. And so a lot of times it doesn't take much to go to your neighbor and say, hey, can I work cattle with you just so I can have some experience with it? I'm sure that the farmer would be really great, would be glad to have that extra help. And also you would learn a tremendous amount just by getting in there and just trying.
What is ahead of you for you today? What are you going to be doing when you leave here?
Well, my responsibility is management of the company itself, but we are in the middle of lambing. And
When all the lambs are born,
that's the time of the year when we're currently having our lambs. And so there's got to be some lamb checks and taking care of the lambs that were not being raised by the ewes, and making sure that the animals are being rotated with the new bales of hay that we're putting out. And hopefully grass will start growing in about 3 weeks.
Jacqueline Smith, thank you. It's so good to see you.
Thank you so very much, Gina.
And Barb Downey, thank you.
Thank you all.
Jacqueline raises grass-fed lamb at Central Grazing Company outside of Lawrence, and Barb joined us from the Kansas Livestock Association. Up next, craft beer. There's a lot of it. Too much? We will find out on KCUR's Central Standard. Kansas City now has enough craft breweries that a guidebook to Kansas City beer exists, and people actually use it to plan weekend beer outings and beer tours. The book is already dated, by the way, because more breweries keep opening, and you could have a festival of strictly local beers, but you'd be face down drunk if you tried every one, or at least I would be. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're asking an important question. Are we in a beer bubble, or is there no such thing? We direct this query to an economist, the chief economist with the Brewers Association, Bart Watson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. First, explain what it is you do exactly.
Well, the Brewers Association is a national trade association that represents small and independent craft brewers, and I'm the one who gets to track all of them, gets to look at the market conditions, and try to provide insights for our members on what's going on in the beer and brewing market.
So is there such a thing as a beer bubble? Too much craft beer for the size of a particular market?
Well, I think in theory, it's possible that that could happen. That said, I think in most markets that we're looking at, we don't see it happening. You know, I'm sure we're going to delve into this in real depth. But what we've seen is, you know, a real shift in demand. And so the reason all these breweries are popping up is because people want to drink their beer and want to go visit them.
I wonder just generally how the economics of beer are different from the economics of any other commodity. What makes the beer economy unique?
Well, at a certain level, it's not any different. You know, you have to make a product and then you sell it and you get your margin. Beer is a much more regulated industry than a lot of others. So that can shift the economics depending on what particular place you're in. So, you know, even between the Kansas side and the Missouri side of the Kansas City market, breweries are going to have, you know, very different operations just based on the state regulatory structure. So because it's that, you know, regulated substance that does often add layers, it adds bureaucracy, it adds additional taxes like excise taxes. But, you know, other than that, we see a variety of business models that look a lot like other consumer product goods.
Does the fact that it can get you drunk change the economy of it? I mean, that every person has theoretically a limit?
Well, that certainly is a part of why it's so regulated. So, you know, on the distribution side, there's an independent distributor tier in most states designed to separate producers and retailers and, you know, remove some of those incentives to just sell as much beer as you can. You know, there are specific rules and, you know, beverage alcohol retailers have these too, but things like dram shop laws that put liability on operators to make sure that they're operating in a safe manner given public health. So, you know, there are additional rules and regulations, excise taxes, which at least in theory are designed to, you know, reduce consumption by putting an additional tax on, you know, a product like beer or, you know, tobacco or other things. So there are some variations that are put in place there. But, you know, beer certainly sometimes has fewer of those or, you know, lower tax rates than, say, spirits, because as a beverage of moderation, you know, it may be, you know, a little bit less regulated in a lot of places.
So quick notes about Kansas City. Last I knew, we were a city of roughly 2 million people, and I'm referring to the greater metropolitan area with that number because people in Overland Park would probably consider Kansas City beers local. So 2 million people-ish, and we have more than 30 breweries. Thoughts on this?
That's very low compared to some other metro areas with that number. You know, I think a lot of times people look at the number of breweries, they see it climbing. We are at a historic high in the United States for the number of breweries. And, you know, they don't think of it in broader context. You know, how big are those breweries? What do they look like? You know, one thing I always try to get people to focus on is not necessarily the number of breweries, but how much beer they're actually making. So, you know, to give an example, if you take the smallest 75% of the breweries in the country, so we're talking about 5,000 plus breweries, and you add them all up, their contribution to the U.S. beer market is about 1 out of 200 beers. So that number of breweries does matter, and certainly we can have a saturation point in the number of breweries in a market. But, you know, 30 in Kansas City, you know, there's two
more than 30.
Yeah,
I just don't know exactly how many more than 30.
And it is changing constantly. I mean, we get about three breweries opening a day nationally. So, you know, Kansas City is not unusual that it's seen a lot of brewery openings recently. But, you know, to give a comparative, and not every place can be a leader. Not every place is going to be a Portland, Oregon, or a San Diego. But, you know, San Diego County, I think, has a fairly similar population to that Kansas City metro area. And there's 180 breweries in San Diego County. So certainly 30 in the context of a 2 million person area. Or, you know, I'll give an example of where I'm based, Boulder, Colorado. We're about a 300,000 person county, and I think we have 50 breweries. So, you know, it's not just how many breweries, but, you know, how much beer are people drinking in that place? What are the demographics of that place? And what do those breweries look like? Can we have 30 big distribution breweries? Probably not. But can you have 30 local microbreweries and brew pubs? Certainly, and there's probably room for more.
So we've kind of asked this question of local brewers, one in particular who's opening up shop in the aftermath of the government shutdown, which slowed him down because of the red tape and licensing and so forth that he kind of couldn't pull off right then. But he came in to talk about the shutdown, and I asked, you know, there are a lot of breweries in town, but he was confident that this really is the kind of thing where it's the more the better. The more people understand and appreciate craft beer and see Kansas City as a place that has it, the better for all of them. True or not true?
I think in the Kansas City market, it's certainly true. You know, when you look at this nationally, again, I think we are seeing places where, you know, a new brewery coming in, that demand can't grow anymore because craft brewers already have 40% market share. But Kansas City is a market that's still growing and developing. And a lot of places, we see a virtuous cycle. So breweries come in, they introduce, you know, local residents to fuller flavored beer from local producers, and that actually grows the demand. So they're putting more into the pie than they're taking out. And I think Kansas City is certainly still in a point in its development as a great beer city where, you know, new breweries come in, as long as they're doing something different, they're differentiating, and they're making great beer, that they're going to have opportunities in the marketplace.
Did you just call that a virtuous cycle?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the opposite would be a, you know, something that spirals downwards. But, you know, in the market terms, what we're really seeing is breweries do very, very well in places where there are other breweries. That's actually one of the best predictors of where a brewery locates, is the presence of another brewery. And that's because they create demand as well as taking out from demand. So, you know, as you're introducing people to, you know, fuller flavored beer, to this variety of styles, to what local production looks like, you know, you can get, again, a virtuous cycle that a brewery coming in actually improves the market for everyone else.
So brewers out there and Kansas City beer drinkers, you are virtuous.
Yes. Well, you know, certainly we in the beer business maybe think about it a little bit different than others. But, you know, in market terms, certainly a brewery coming in doesn't necessarily just have to take out, they can put in. And I think that's, you know, the basic point I'm trying to make.
I think the reason that I'm asking about this, though, is because, like, when I think about all of the announcements about breweries opening, just that kind of attention you want to get when you're saying something like, hey, new brewery in town, like when there's tons of, when it feels like that's happening a lot, how do you get attention? How do you, I mean, it feels almost like there could be a novelty that wears off, or is this just a culture that is changing and you see reason to believe will continue to move in this same direction?
Well, I think it can be a little bit of both. I think certainly overall, we're seeing the demand for beer shift in this country. People want fuller flavor. They want more variety. They want locally made products from small and independent producers. And that's something that we've seen, you know, it's been a long shift going on for 30 or 40 years. It's not just in beer. It's in coffee. It's in a lot of consumer product goods. People want to know where what they're putting in their bodies was made. They want to have a connection to that company, and people are generally looking for flavor and variety. You know, that said, brewers who jump in and are only trying to capitalize on this trend and, you know, don't really have a great brand identity, don't have an ethos, you know, do run the risk of, you know, as consumer demand cools, you know, as it will, we always see cycles in any consumer product good. You know, those are the brewers who do run the risk of having only that novelty factor to go on and, you know, getting outcompeted, because the market is going to get more competitive as we see more and more breweries enter.
There's this one local brewery in Kansas City, Boulevard. They, at one point, I would say that they were almost like the beer version of our baseball team. You know what I mean? They were like the hometown beer. So supporting Boulevard, drinking Boulevard, a lot of people sort of acted like that was supporting Kansas City by extension. There was a lot of pride wrapped up in that. And I think there still kind of is. Over time, is there a risk of diluting that? And how do things shift as maybe no one brewery can be that?
You know, it's certainly a great question, and one that, you know, every brewery is going to have to think about in their local market and where they sit. You know, luckily for, you know, a lot of companies, as the total demand grows, you know, that total pie grows. And so, you know, even if that local bit that is being split up in more ways, you know, there may still be enough for every brewery. You know, certainly we are seeing challenges for breweries like Boulevard that, you know, grew in a different era when there weren't as many breweries. They built their brand and are now having to, you know, rethink their place in the market as we see other local options. You know, Boulevard's a classic, you know, brewery, a craft brewer, lots of great beers, you know, has a wide portfolio. So I think they're going to do just fine and, you know, have a strong connection to the city of Kansas City already. So, but it's certainly something brewers need to think about as we see more and more breweries enter. You know, what do you stand for? And if you only stand for local, there's going to be a lot of local choices. So you got to make sure your brand, you know, has that local dimension, but has other things as well.
There's I wouldn't call it a Boulevard equivalent, but there's a brewery in Lawrence that has that similar relationship with the city of Lawrence, Kansas. That's Free State Brewery. Is that one you've heard of?
Oh, yes, certainly. You know, Free State's, you know, another brewery that's been around for a long time. Breweries in Kansas have never gotten quite as big as breweries in Missouri for a whole variety of reasons. So, you know, they're not distributed quite as widely as Boulevard, which, you know, really is a Midwest regional brewer, not just a Kansas City brewer. But, you know, Free State and other great breweries. And, you know, there's great breweries in almost every town in America now. 85% of 21-plus adults live within 10 miles of a brewery. So, you know, most cities with some significant population are going to have at least one local brewery, if not multiple ones. And that's one of the things that's great. You know, you can have some local beers in almost every place you go. And, you know, we're seeing brewery tourism, for example, rise as a result of this.
What are some of the factors that influence a local beer economy that people might not just immediately, intuitively think about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. You know, regulation, I've already mentioned, is going to be really important. So, you know, states really vary on how much market access they give brewers. You know, can you sell beer to go with different license types? Can you self-distribute? You know, how big can you be if you want some of these rights and responsibilities? So that's going to influence it. You know, I think some of the historical factors are important, too. They impact labor markets. You know, how many people are there who have worked in a brewery and are thinking about, you know, opening a brewery and have beer knowledge? You know, we do see regional variations in just taste and preferences. So you'll see beer styles in certain places that are very, very popular and in other places they aren't. You know, some of those can be based on, you know, the demographics, you know, historical patterns of who lives there. Some of those are just, you know, what are the flavors that people in those places drink? So
wait, can you talk a little bit more about that? What's Kansas City's deal?
You know, I'm not enough of an expert on Kansas City to delve that deep, but, you know, we see a lot of Midwest markets where, you know, they have that stronger German population, and so, you know, lagers and maltier beers do a little bit better than, you know, other places where they don't have that, as you know, connection to that historic, you know, brewing tradition of Germany, for instance. You know, in Florida, we're seeing, you know, a lot of tropical fruit beers, you know, Berliner Weisses with fruits, Florida Weiss. So you can certainly see kind of pockets of places where, you know, a particular style is more popular than other places. And now IPA is ubiquitous everywhere. So these are smoothing out a little bit as we get more of a national market.
How do you know if you are reaching a saturation point, or what we like to call, as of this week, a beer bubble?
Sure. And, you know, I'll again stress, you know, I don't think we're seeing a bubble. It's not something that's going to burst. You know, in 5 or 10 years, we're not going to see fewer breweries nationally than we see now. But, you know, I would say, you know, a mature market is one that looks a lot like, you know, something like maybe, say, the restaurant industry, where, you know, nobody questions when a new one opens, but the assumption is we're not going to have, you know, 10,000 more restaurants, because if one comes in, one might have to close. And I think that's what we're starting to see in some of the, you know, furthest along markets, places like Portland, Oregon, where, you know, breweries are still opening if they think they can do something different, if they have a new idea, if somebody's really excited about, you know, putting in the hard work and starting a brewery. But it's hard to grow that pie because the share is so high already. And so when one opens, it's normally, you know, a corresponding closing is going on as well.
Before we go, I mean, I think a lot of the economists out there are probably feeling pretty envious of your sweet gig as a beer economist. So I'm curious about whether there are downsides you'd like to share to make them feel better.
I would like to, but, you know, I'm trying to be honest in this interview. So being a beer economist is just about the best job you can have. If you're going to count ones and zeros, they might as well be beers.
How did you get into this anyway?
I was formerly a professor. I taught, you know, a wide range of political economy classes, and I was super lucky to stumble across the Brewers Association website when I was doing a lecture on excise taxes, which, you know, maybe not the most exciting topic, but it led me to the world of beer, and I couldn't be happier. It's been a great industry to track, and you know, beer and brewery people are wonderful people, so that's one of the best parts of being in the industry.
What is your favorite kind of beer?
You know, it really changes by the season. You know, I love Belgian-influenced beers. So, you know, I'll say, since we've talked about Boulevard, you know, if you like those beers, you know, checking out Tank 7, it's a great, great Kansas City beer, a classic. That's one I've had a fair amount of. But, you know, it really depends on what time of year, what I'm eating. There's so many varieties and styles out there that, you know, limiting yourself to just one, you know, seems crazy in this day and age.
So our theory about a beer bubble is just totally flawed. Any trends that are real and happening that you'd like to cue us in on before we go?
Well, you know, it is definitely a more competitive market out there. So we are seeing closings go up, but that's just a mature market. And we're going to continue to see brewery openings. We're going to continue to see beer grow. It's a great time to be a beer lover.
Well, Bart Watson, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Bart is the chief economist of the Brewers Association, and he says, we don't sound like we are in a beer bubble in Kansas City. You heard it here. Listen back to this discussion or anything else that's been on today's Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard. Those conversations will be posted by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. Talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. We love knowing what you're thinking about, what you think we should be talking about. We want to exchange banter with you, so talk to us there. At KCURCST on Twitter. Tomorrow is a food show. We'll talk about a New Orleans-Kansas City culinary connection in case you're still craving red beans and rice after Mardi Gras, and we'll search for the city's best cinnamon roll. That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Sylvia Maria Gross, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.